Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to open the show learning about a program that's been going on for 25 years and is happening this week. It's the annual rabies bait drop being conducted by the USDA Wildlife Services along with the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. Joining us for a few minutes before he heads out to continue the task of setting the rabies bait out is USDA wildlife biologist Owen Montgomery. Owen, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us this morning.
Glad to be with you, Rick.
All right. So, Owen, let's find out about, you know, why is this an annual event that the USDA and the Fish and Wildlife have to do each year?
Well, the main reason for it in the premise is to stop the northward spread of the terrestrial strain of rabies and eventually move towards possibly a plan for elimination and moving it southward out of New England and toward the eastern seaboard.
What animals do you target in this bait drop, Owen?
Well, our target animals are raccoons, skunks, and foxes primarily. You know, any warm-blooded mammal can get rabies, but there are only certain animals that are considered vector species that are actually able to spread the disease and infect other animals.
How is rabies spread?
Well, contrary to popular belief, it's actually spread in either saliva or mucous membrane or central nervous tissue. It's not spread by blood, and a lot of people think that is. And that, for that reason, that's why, you know, a rabies exposure would be an actual scratch or a bite by a rabid animal.
Have we seen much in Vermont so far this year as far as rabies?
We have not. And historically, our cases are going, our cases of terrestrial rabies, not including bats, is trending downward over the course of the last several years. There's 10 cases so far this year in the state of Vermont. I believe four of those are raccoons, and I don't have it right in front of me, but I think two of those were cats, and the rest are bats.
And you say terrestrial rabies. What is that?
Well, terrestrial meaning the strain of rabies that can be transmitted through terrestrial animals, so not bats. Because
okay.
Bats are mammals, yes, but they're flying around, so that would be more aerial transmission rather than terrestrial.
All right. And is there, this is not focused on them. Is there any way that we do try to rein in the rabies of bats? Owen, you still with us? Oh, boy. All right. Let's see if we can get Owen back on. I think he's calling right back. I think we just lost him. But this will happen on a cell phone. And he is out in the field getting ready to place rabies in the field today. So I do appreciate that Owen has been able to give us a few minutes. All right. Let's see. Owen, you with us again?
I am. I apologize. I don't know what happened.
That's all right. We all understand cell service in Vermont, so these things will happen.
Yeah.
Is there a similar program for bats to control their rabies?
There's not. I'm sure there's some research going on out there in the biological world somewhere, but at this point, as far as we're concerned, working on, there is not a specific program for controlling rabies and bats.
No. Okay. All right. So where are you placing the rabies bait?
Well, so we do it three different we use three different methods. One is by fixed-wing aircraft. The other is by helicopter or rotary-wing aircraft. And the other is by hand, which is actually what we're in the Burlington area doing today. So how we decide on where to place the baits is based on habitat type, and estimated density of our vector species or the species that we would consider targets. And that has to do with a lot of land data through GIS and mapping and that sort of thing. And that's how we come up with our flight transects and what densities we're going to be placing our baits at to better target the species that we're looking to have intersect their baits.
Now, when you place by hand, that's pretty obvious how you can get it in a specific place you need it. But when you're in the air with a airplane or helicopter, you know, are you able to get it close to where you need it to be? And how safe is it for people who might be hiking in that area, let's say?
So when we're flying and placing the putting the baits out, we have the machines fairly well dialed in and calibrated, and we have meters inside the machine. There's two people operating the machine plus a pilot, and we feel that we are exceptionally accurate at placing them where they need to be and avoiding things like pools in people's backyards mm-hmm. and other public areas where the public may come in contact with them or the public's domestic pets. So it's really quite safe. It's not a hazard to humans. You know, let's just say 99.9% of the time, nobody will even see them. They're well camouflaged and meant to attract wildlife.
What's actually
in the event that? Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the event that a domestic pet may come in contact with them, which does happen occasionally,
mm-hmm.
Especially if there are people are walking them unleashed, it will not serve to vaccinate your domestic animal. The worst it would do if they ingested a bait might give them an upset stomach for a day or so, okay. But there will be no other adverse effects.
What's actually in that bait? Do we know?
Well, it's a vaccine. It's a I'll try to remember the name of it right now, but it's a adenovirus type vaccine,
mm-hmm.
which triggers an immune response in the animal to create their own antibodies to the disease.
Mm-hmm. How long is that bait effective for, Owen?
Well, that's currently being studied, but the last literature that we're using says it should be applied once a year. There's also some thought processes and studies going on as to whether you know, mothers can pass that on to their young of the year or not, but there's nothing definitive stating that at this point.
If someone does have it placed in a inappropriate place, you know, maybe on their property, any ideas on what they should do to actually move it if necessary?
Yeah, so what we suggest is that people use some sort of an implement like a shovel or certainly protective handwear like gloves and just simply place it back in the woods where it won't be you know, discovered by any other domestic pets or humans. If they have any other questions, if they turn the bait over, there is a toll-free number on the back of the bait, which will route them to the Vermont Rabies Hotline, which is 1-800-472-2437. Or they can call that number directly if they feel like they've come in contact with maybe a packet that has been punctured. And we can walk them through. We've got specific state protocol on you know, how to triage those calls from the public.
And even easier way to remember that number, 1-800-4-RABIES, if you happen to come upon it. Are the packs clearly marked that people will know that they have indeed come upon a rabies bait pack?
Yes, it will say so. There is printed writing on the backside of the packet.
All right, great. And Owen, is there anything else people should know about the drop or about the bait packs?
Not really. It's like you stated earlier, this is our 25th year of this oral rabies vaccination efforts. We do it every year at the same time to help manage wildlife and rabies and wildlife. And if they find a packet and have any questions, feel free to give the Vermont Rabies Hotline a call, and we can walk you through what needs to happen or what doesn't need to happen.
We
appreciate public's support of our program, and we're just trying to keep everybody and all pets safe from disease that is certainly detrimental.
And the hotline number again, 1-800-4-RABIES. That's 1-800-472-2437. Owen Montgomery is a wildlife biologist for the USDA. So thanks so much. I know you've got a busy time right now, and I appreciate you taking a few minutes to let us know all about the drop.
Glad to be with you. We always, we encourage engaging with the public.
All right. Take care, Owen.
Take care, Rick. Thank you.
You too. All right, we're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. There we go. You know, I got to interview Dave Matthews once. Interesting cat. He, his family were missionaries in South Africa. So I think like during his teen years, he grew up in Virginia. And then in those teen years, when you're hanging out in high school, he was, with his parents in South Africa. And so, we had a great discussion about apartheid and about Bishop Desmond Tutu. He's a real cerebral cat, you know. He's a smart guy, a real thinker, Dave Matthews. So, yeah, it was a really enjoyable conversation. All right, now you get the monologue. So I want to thank Owen Montgomery. I know they've got a lot of work getting that bait out, and that is, you know, quite a undertaking that they do. They have to get it done in just a few days each year. So I appreciate him taking the time. But another big thing happened yesterday, and that was the border reopening. But it's not as clear-cut as it was, where you just pull up and can go across the border, you know, with just the general customs questions. As a matter of fact, there was the possibility of a strike by Canadian customs workers. That was averted this weekend. So that's one thing you do not have to worry about heading north. But I do want to spend this first segment trying to explain the rules for crossing the border into Canada now that it is reopened. I do want to also tell you that at 9:30, we're going to visit the home of the great Red Sox outfielder Ted Williams. He once owned here in Vermont. I had no idea Teddy Ballgame had a place in Vermont. And boy, you know, the late Howard Frank Mosier, I wonder if he knew. He had written that wonderful novel, Waiting for Teddy Williams. If you're a Sox fan and you've never read it, that is a must read. 10 o'clock, Jack T. Scully will join us. We're going to read some, he's going to read some of his poems. His new book is called Mayanus Village, which is the area he grew up in. It was a neighborhood in Greenwich, Connecticut. And then at 10:30, we will open the phones up for you. So here we go. Let's get started trying to unwind the rules for crossing the border now that we're able to go to Canada again, vaccinated. That's a key word. All right. Here's what the Canadian government had to say about crossing the border. Now, I know it might be a little dense, but then I also have what VT Digger has put out. They kind of broke it down, and that'll help. But I do want to read the rules that the Canadian government has set. To be eligible to enter Canada for discretionary travel, that's what we do, on the basis of vaccination status, travelers must use the Arrive CAN, C-A-N, app. This is important. The Arrive CAN app or web portal. Travelers must ensure that mandatory requirements are met prior to departing for Canada. In addition, some provinces and territories may have their own entry restrictions in place. In addition to receiving a full series of a vaccine authorized by the Canadian government, the fully vaccinated travelers must also, so keep in mind, just because you're vaccinated, that doesn't get you across the border. You must also provide COVID-19-related information electronically through ArriveCan, the app or the web portal, including proof of vaccination prior to arrival in Canada. You must meet the pre-entry testing requirements. That's the big one right there, my friends. Keep that in mind. So you've got this ArriveCan app, and you have to be vaccinated, and you have to meet the pre-entry testing requirements. You have to be asymptomatic upon arrival, have a paper or digital copy of your vaccination documentation in English or French, or a certified translation, and you must be ready to show a government official on request this information as evidence, all right? A person who submits false information, pay attention to this, do not go up there and lie because you're not going to like this. A person who submits false information on vaccination status could be liable of a fine of up to $750,000. Now, that is Canadian, so it's a little bit less. Nonetheless, it's still a chunk of change. You don't want to be messing with Pierre Trudeau and the gang up there. Okay, it could also be 6 months imprisonment or both under the Quarantine Act or prosecution under the Criminal Code of Forgery. violating any quarantine or isolation instructions provided to travelers by a screening officer or quarantine officer when entering Canada is also an offense under the Quarantine Act and could lead to a $5,000 fine, Canadian, for each day of noncompliance for each offense committed, or more serious penalties, including 6 months in prison and or $750,000 in fines. Noncompliant air travelers may also be subject to fines of up to $5,000 for each offense committed under the Aeronautics Act. You didn't know we had a Quarantine Act and an Aeronautics Act, or they did. Anyway, even if you're converting it into Canadian dollars, you don't want to be socked with those. So do not try to go up there and sneak through with false information. Not a great idea, all right? So that's what the Canadian government is telling you. And it's important to check out this Arrive Can app or web portal before you go across. Do not drive up to the border and just think you're going to hand them information like your vaccination card. You need to be tested, but you also need to put the information in the Arrive Can app, all right? Now, here's what VT Digger had to say. This is a little bit clearer, but nonetheless, it'll tell you the same thing. U.S. citizens who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can visit Canada starting yesterday, and that was announced by the Canadian government. The northern border will be open to any Americans who present proof of full vaccination, either two doses of the Pfizer, Moderna, or AstraZeneca vaccines, or one dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So they're taking all the vaccines that we have here. I don't think we've used AstraZeneca here. I think that's for Europeans. Travelers must also be asymptomatic upon arrival. Keep that in mind. And have obtained a negative PCR test within 3 days before crossing the border. And you need to submit the information to Canadian government's Arrive Can portal and carry a paper or digital copy of the vaccination documentation to show officials upon request. Now, just remember, too, that sometimes your cell phone, and that's where you probably have your digital information, you get up there, you've got roaming charges, and sometimes, you know, you don't want to pay those. So make sure you have the paper backup with you. Just a thought. All right, let's see. What else do we know? There will be no quarantine restrictions upon arrival, but travelers are expected to follow any local public health guidelines at their destination. And according to the CBC, unvaccinated children, now you might have questions about children, unvaccinated children may also get a pass. A government official told the CBC that children under 12 who are not yet eligible for the vaccine will be allowed to enter the country without quarantining so long as they remain with their parents and follow public health guidelines. All right, so your 10-year-old can't run free once they're across the Canadian border. They got to stick with you. All right, so those are the main rules. If you have questions about them, you can call and I can pretend to give you an answer, or we can dig back through what I've just read. But it is pretty straightforward that you're not going to drive to the border, show your vaccine card, or you're not going to drive to the border and get in unvaccinated. All right. You need to have a test within 72 hours of heading up to Canada, and you need to put this information in this Arrive Can. That's, you know, the words Arrive C-A-N app or web portal. You can find that online. You know, if you're not tech savvy, if you don't have internet access, you're probably not going to get across the border. That's a thing to consider as well. You know, so do not just point the car north quite yet, but if you can meet the requirements that the Canadian government has set out, they're not particularly rigorous, but they will indeed be policed. So really not worth trying to head up there and clogging up things at the border. All right, there you go. Let's see. So I ran through the rules of heading to Canada. If you have questions, feel free. You can call now or at 10:30. We're going to open up the phones. And then at 10:30, we'll also talk about great places in Quebec that you're anxious to go to. We did this the other day and got some great ideas, a couple great restaurants to suggest that I have. You'll be able to hear those later on. I think I'm going to save those for the 10:30 because, La Lu and has anyone ever been to Luf? All right, I'll tell you a quick story about Luf. It's not in Montreal. It's just north of Bedford in this little village of Mystic. There's a beautiful old round barn. It's like a 16-sided round barn right next to it. And Luf is, it's a chocolate shop and little French goodies up front. And then in the back is a restaurant that is French country cuisine. And it is fantastic. And it's not that far across the border. If you know where Bedford is, pretty much go across the border and make, I think, the second right. You're going to head back east to Bedford. Once you hit Bedford, take a left, go north, and then you'll see these little signs for this village called Mystic. And Luf is back there. First time I went up, I couldn't find it, and I flagged down an old Quebecois and said, I'm looking for Le Ouf. Le Ouf? This is me talking French. Yes, Le Ouf. And he looks at my paper and he says, Luf. Oh, okay. Luf, it means the egg, and it's not pronounced Le Ouf. How to get a rise out of Canadians. All right. But it is a fabulous restaurant. We'll talk more about that at 10:30. Coming up next, what do we got? Oh, the Ted Williams home is what we're going to talk about next. All right. Let's go to a break. We're going to hit some CBS News. And this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Stengary. By the time I was aware of baseball in 1966, Ted Williams was out of the game for six seasons. I knew his name from the Sears and Roebuck fishing tackle my grandfather would buy with Ted's name on it, and from when he managed the Washington Senators to an actual winning season and a few years with the Texas Rangers. Since then, I've been filling in the blanks about the amazing batting feats of this once great Red Sox outfielder, and even more impressive, his service to this country during World War II and the Korean War. His stats flying for the Navy are admirable as well. Well, just a few weeks ago, I found one more missing piece of the Ted Williams puzzle. He and his wife owned a place in Vermont. It's in southern Vermont and is aptly named the Splendid Splinter Vacation Rental. That was one of his nicknames. Here to tell us about it is Adrian Holland. She's the property manager of the Splendid Splinter. Adrian, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me today, Rick. I'm really looking forward to talking with you this morning. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
I have to tell you, people are just amazed when I tell them Ted Williams lived in Vermont. this is so great. Listeners, if you have a question about the Splendid Splinter and how you can stay there, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, there's one thing you need to clear up because I want to make sure I give the proper nod to the proper place. I've seen the location as listed as Putney and as Westminster West, and it's kind of almost between the two, but where is the Splendid Splinter?
So that's actually funny that you point that out. We get that a lot from people that want to come and stay. We actually ride the line equally between Putney and Westminster, but we actually have the address listed as Westminster, Vermont.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. We'll give the nod to the folks in Westminster West, and they love their village. All right. That's great. Oh, it is. So I looked on the map. It looked like that, like it's on the line. All right.
Yeah.
Now, Adrian, tell us what's on the property at the Splendid Splinter.
So the Splendid Splinter Splinter is a 60-acre property, and it basically was owned by Ted Williams and his Vogue model wife, Dolores Wedick Williams. And on the property, we have the main house, which is basically been renovated. It's a late 1800 farmhouse, post and beam home, that was renovated, and that sleeps about, around 11 people comfortably. And then attached to that is a barn apartment, and that is affectionately known, as the Sweetheart Barn. It was a long, standing wish of Dolores to restore. It had always been a working barn, but to actually make it into a getaway on the property. And, their daughter, Claudia Williams, who has lovingly restored this whole property, made that vision a reality.
So in the Sweetheart Barn, is that a rental space for events, or can some people stay there? Is it separate from the house where somebody could rent that and the house, or do you get it all?
That's a great question. So you actually have multiple opportunities within the property. So people can rent either just the house, and then the barn is actually a separate, it's got its own separate private entrance, its own separate kitchen, everything. And that's really designed for just two people. And then if people want to rent the whole property, which we actually have had a couple of occasions, they can rent both the main house and the Sweetheart Barn. But each entity is separate unto itself.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right.
Yeah.
Now, we know a lot about Ted.
Yes.
But we don't know a lot about Dolores, and she was pretty interesting herself, a former Miss Vermont. So tell us about Dolores.
Dolores is just an amazing woman. She came from very humble beginnings. Her parents were Swiss and Swedish, and she actually was born in New York, but then they moved into Vermont and actually lived very close to where the Splendid Splinter is located. They lived literally maybe a half mile down the road. She grew up with her parents and siblings, very beautiful, very smart. Went to University of Vermont on a scholarship to become a nurse. And during her time there, a professor actually filled out all the paperwork for her to participate in the Miss Vermont pageant. They basically did it as kind of a surprise. It wasn't really her that had any plans to do that. So she goes and does this pageant, wins the pageant, becomes Miss Vermont. And, you know, that was kind of it from there. She basically had no further plans of doing any more pageants or anything like that, and becomes a nurse. Is in New York City doing continuing education for her nursing, and is actually spotted by two photographers who approach her and say, you look so much like Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. We'd love to get a couple pictures of you. And as they say, the rest was history. These gentlemen take her picture. It gets sent in. She then becomes one of the first women to be on the cover of Vogue Paris, travels all over the world doing modeling shoots. She was on the cover of Esquire magazine, the cover of a magazine called The Queen. And then actually Sophia Loren's husband, by the last name of Ponti, is a famous Italian director, and he actually saw her picture in Vogue magazine, and he cast her in his movie, his Italian movie. Yeah, so she led an amazing life, and then meets Ted Williams. They have two beautiful children, and she raises them and demonstrates the value of hard work, working on the property in Vermont.
One of the hardest things in her life was telling people that you're Swiss and Swedish. That's not an easy thing to say. Now, you talked about the surprise of the professor filling out her application for Miss Vermont, but Dolores herself had quite a surprise for Ted with the house.
Yes, that is such an amazing story. I'm so glad that you're kind of bringing that to light.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't know that Ted and Dolores actually met. She was doing a modeling shoot in Australia. Ted Williams was doing a fishing trip in Queensland, Australia. And they end up on the same flight. Now, Dolores Williams has no idea. She doesn't know baseball. Her father didn't watch baseball. You know, she just kind of was in Vermont and, you know, being a nurse. And she really doesn't have an appreciation for who Ted Williams is. So he sees her on the airplane. He writes on a napkin, "Who are you?" Balls it up and throws it behind him. It lands on her lap, and she opens it up, and not knowing who he is, she writes back, "Well, who are you?" and tosses it back forward. So they, throughout the whole flight, they're talking to each other, and she actually doesn't give him her phone number. She gives him her address. And so they meet up in New York City again, and they talk and are very enamored with each other, and then she brings him home. And for those who, you know Ted Williams, they know that he was a very, very private person, as was Dolores. And he absolutely loved Vermont. He loved going up to the house, which is now where the Splendid Splinter is, and they fall in love. Well, they move into the house, which is actually down by the road, and word gets out that Ted Williams is living in town. People are starting to pull in the driveway, catch a glimpse, ask for autographs, and he does not like this. So he starts complaining to his new wife about, you know, wanting privacy and needing to get away and things like this. He doesn't want people pulling into the yard. And so he goes away for a baseball expedition, and while he's away, she decides that she's going to do what she can to make her new husband happy, and she decides that she's going to move the house.
Move the house.
Move the house. So she involves a very famous covered bridge builder, Milton Greaton, and a team of several men in town. They actually jack the house up and get it onto some trailers with a team of oxen and pull it up this very, very steep hill to the very top of the property, which is where the house rests today. So, you know, This is in the 70s. I mean, we don't, you know, it's not like we have text messaging and things like that. So when they would talk on the phone once a week, she kept telling him, "Oh, I have such a surprise for you. I have such a surprise for you." Well, she at the time was also pregnant with her second child, her daughter, Claudia. And, you know, he's thinking it's going to be the baby. Well, he squeals into the driveway and his house is gone.
Surprise.
For those that know him and know that he has a knack for a very colorful language, you know, he wonders where the beep his house is, you know? I mean, he's wondering what has happened to where he knows he lives. Well, he drives out of the driveway, and then he pulls off the road, and he's like, "I know that is where my house was. I'm driving back." So he pulls back in the driveway. The house is still gone, but now he sees his beautiful wife with their brand new baby in her arms, but that the house is at the top of the hill.
I love that story.
And it is magical. There is a picture in Claudia Williams, who is their daughter, the sole surviving heir of the Williams name. wrote a book called Ted Williams, My Father, and that story is featured in there. And there is a picture of them standing together, and Ted Williams has John Henry on his hip. Dolores is holding Claudia, and he is looking at her like, I cannot believe you are amazing. I cannot believe this. Who have I married?
You have moved the house.
Yeah.
Adrian Holland, you are the best guest ever for bleeping out curse words. In one of my past lives, I had a client in Lecanto, Florida, very close to where the Ted Williams Museum and Hitters Hall of Fame had been located. It's since been moved to the Trop in Tampa, in St. Pete. I made several visits to the baseball shrine of this Hall of Fame, and Vermonters, now you have a Teddy ballgame shrine of your own here in the Green Mountain State. The kid once owned a place in Westminster West, and it's now the Splendid Splinter Vacation Rental. The property manager is Adrian Holland. She's with us for a few more minutes to tell us about it. If you've got a question or a comment, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And let's take a call from Bob, calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Bob.
Morning. How are you?
Good.
Big Ted Williams fan. I go back to the being in Fenway Park in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
Watching him play. So I've followed him through the years. Regarding a couple of points, he served two stints in the service.
Yep.
In the heart of his career.
Yep.
And remember, in 1941, in fact, he hit 406, the last man to hit 400.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was known as had the greatest eyesight in baseball. He was always called the greatest hitter ever, regardless of all the other facts and people. But he gave up his a chance at being a much larger figure in his career.
Yeah.
For his service to the military. He was a Marine pilot.
Yes, he was. And
he was in World War II and the Korean War, if I'm not mistaken.
You're absolutely right, Bob, and I'm glad you bring that up. When we look at his total stats, and almost three full seasons missed, he served 2 years, I think, in World War II, and then really didn't have to go back for the Korean War, and he does misses pretty much a whole season for that too. So as a great hitter, and we all know that, but that bit of information, Bob, absolutely why I respect him so much today. I love learning about him. Adrian, I want to ask you to give us a quick kind of walkthrough of the house, the Splendid Splinter.
Sure. First of all, when you pull into the driveway, you'll come through this beautiful iron gate, and then you travel up. It's about a quarter of a mile up the driveway, and you kind of wind through this just beautiful sanctuary that's very private, very exclusive. And as you pull into the driveway, you see the barn, which is the Sweetheart Barn, and then which sits atop a stone garage. And then as you walk in to the side entrance, you'll walk through the dining room, which has a ton of really intimate family portraits and family pictures of and a lot of pictures from Ted Williams' career, actually his military service as well. That's the main dining room, which has a beautiful stone fireplace, floor-to-ceiling windows, so you can look out on the Connecticut River Valley. And then you walk through, and then it's a beautiful open kitchen and living room with not only, Ted Williams was very famous, obviously, in his own right, but we also have a lot of pieces from Dolores Wedick Williams' career as well. A lot of magazine covers and, again, very, very intimate portraits and pictures that really captures their life. They fell in love on this property, and they raised their kids here. So you walk through and you kind of are taken along on a journey of their life, of their love, of raising their children, We have a lot of pieces personally inscribed to the kids from Ted Williams. And then we also feature a couple of his batting awards. We have the silver bat from Louisville Slugger that features, it's from his 1941 year where he hit 406, but still loses out on MVP, so, which is unbelievable. But, and then you go upstairs and there's two bedrooms upstairs. Every room in the house is named after a part of their lives. So downstairs we have the kid, which is, of course, as many people know, that was his nickname when he came onto the scene. And so we have that bedroom, and then we have the queen, which was the nickname that was lovingly bestowed to Dolores by Mr. Williams. And then upstairs we have Miss Vermont, which she was Miss Vermont and then became a model and an actress. And then we have, of course, 406, which is features some absolutely stunning pictures, one of which is a very, very beautiful picture of his very first at-bat in a Red Sox uniform. It's at an exhibition game at Fitton Field at the Holy Cross.
Oh, my goodness. Adrian, we're running out of time. I want to make sure people know, how do they make reservations? We've got about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, so go on to Evolve Vacation Rentals, search under Westminster, Vermont, and you will find us. We are listed under the Sweetheart Barn and the Timeless Red Sox Retreat. And then if you have any further questions, you can call 352-436-2701, and we can answer any questions that you have.
All right. Adrian Holland is the property manager for the Splendid Splinter Vacation Rental. As she mentioned, you can visit evolvevacationrental.com or call 352-436-2701. Adrian, thank you so much for sharing all of this with us this morning. This is great.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Take care. It's time to pop out for the news. Then we'll be back to hear some of the poetry of Jack T. Scully. And speaking of the Sox, back in action tonight. They'll be taking on the Tampa Bay Rays. Coverage starts at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Inside my copy of his new collection of poems, Jack Scully wrote, "Enjoy this little trip to simpler, saner days of the 1950s and early 1960s. When you read Mayanus Village by Jack T. Scully, you are transported to a different era altogether. When we didn't, as kids, wear seatbelts, when we were outside taking more risks, we were getting dirtier, catching fish and other critters. The poems in Mayanna's Village could be strung together to the perfect coming-of-age film set in mid-century Connecticut. Jack Scully has had a career in high tech and has written fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. He joins us now. Jack, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Listeners, to ask Jack about his collection of poems, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jack, give us a little background. First of all, am I saying it right, Mayanus Village?
You're close. It's Mayanus.
Mayanus. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So give us a little background about this place.
Okay, so Mayanus Village, after World War II, the Greatest Generation came marching home. You know, these were 16 million people, you know, men and women who fought in the big World War II. And when they came home, they needed education, jobs, and shelter, right? And the GI Bill was there, had been passed by FDR in the Congress in 1944. So when they came home, all of these little starter houses were built around the country for these vets. In Greenwich, Connecticut, where I grew up, they happened to put together one of these little enclaves on this beautiful river called the Mayanus River. And 40 matchbox houses were built within about a year and a half. To get in, the vet had to have be married, at least two kids, and low income.
Now, your poems seem to capture the real flavor of what it was like growing up there. Have you had friends who grew up in that area with you read them and get a reaction?
Oh yeah. We've had a mini reunion, in fact, in June, just before the book was published. There still are a number of alumni from Mayanus Village who I'm in contact with, and they're pretty thrilled, you know. The book is composite, it's fiction, but it does tell an imaginative story. And if you had grown up there in the 50s, you might recognize yourself in some of these poems.
All right. Well, I'd love for you to start us off by you choosing one to read. I'm going to pick some that I really loved, but why don't you pick one to start us with?
Okay. You know, the book was published by Antrim House publishers in Bloomfield, Connecticut, and they're pretty selective. When I submitted the entry to be published, they said, "Send us three poems, and if we like them, we'll ask for the full manuscript." Okay, let me pick three of the 36, and the one that I guess got a lot of resonance was this one called "Why Gunner Drink Warm Beer." You know, when I talk about these 16 million that came home, 400,000 did not come home. They died in the war, you know, to save the world from tyranny and genocide. 400,000 injured, maybe a million severely wounded or crippled. But Rick, another thing that was happening, I guess they called it shell shock back in those days.
Right.
But a lot of these guys came home with mental and emotional problems. I had an uncle that came home with amnesia. He didn't know where he was for 6 months, in and out of the hospitals in Southern Connecticut, even at Yale, before he finally figured out that he had been a loadmaster on C-47s flying the hump from India to China. So there were a lot of issues, and Gunner tries to capture one of those fellows. And here's the poem. Why Gunner drank warm beer. Daddy said Gunner was a natural born killer, but I didn't know what that meant until one Saturday about dusk when his daughter Lisa screamed snake. And we all ran to her backyard to see a copperhead slithering across the gray bark of an oak tree. Pretty soon, half the kids in the village were staring at its bronze bands and flickering tongue. Right away, Gunner pushed us aside, took one look at the snake, and decapitated it with a hatchet. Then aimed his bloodshot eyes at us and belched, "Now get the hell out of here, all of you." Later that night, Gunner showed up with a rattling case of warm Schaefer beer that Daddy said tasted like horse piss, but kept swigging anyway because he loved to get Gunner talking about machine-gunning Nazis from Normandy to Nuremberg. By 10 o'clock, I was in bed, crooking my neck for another story, when I heard Gunner crying like a baby. And Mother whispering to him, sobbing between words, he moaned, "Son of a bitch, Mary, I'm so goddamn scared of going to hell, it's killing me." To which she replied, "Just because you've been to the devil's gate, Joseph, don't mean you got to go in."
Oh, wow. You have such a vivid memory of these things that happened in your childhood. And I love, Jack, that every poem in the collection tells me a story of that time in your life and then keeps adding another chapter that allows us to get to know you and Mayanus Village. Was that your intent as you put together this collection?
As you said, when I got, I went to St. Mike's, graduated, went through the ROTC program, and when I got out of the service, I got into the high tech, industry, and worked for Pohemus and locally here in Burlington area, and then founded our own company, Ascension Technology, which we eventually sold. It was only about that time in 2012 that I really had the time to look back at this era in the 1950s. And I remember going to my hometown, and we were sitting around we were in the Veterans of Foreign Wars a lounge, having a few drinks, and a lot of the Mianus Village alumni were there. And of course, they were remembering these stories, and they triggered a lot of these memories that had been long forgotten. And, it's just an opportunity to start putting them together in a collection, and now they're published.
All right. Well, it's time for my choice. I'd love for you to flip to page 20 and read for us Halloween.
Oh, gee. Well, that was another a couple more bets, and it gives you a good flavor for their sense of humor, yeah, mm-hmm. at the expense of these baby boomer kids. But Halloween, yes, here it is. One year, Howie Shiner, draped in torn bedsheets and blowing smoke rings from a Marlboro cigarette, led us kids around the village for trick-or-treating. But first, he gathered us in a circle for bold-popping snapshots and a ghost story. Dressed in homemade costumes and sweaty plastic masks, expressive no doubt of our embryonic personalities, we were cap-gun-toting cowboys, painted Indians, witches, pirates, my dream occupation, and fairy princesses. I was swaying back and forth as Howie asked us if we knew the real meaning of Halloween. When we shook our heads no, he whispered, "It is the one night of the year when the living dead walk the earth." Deep in the woods, wind rustled through the trees, and an owl hooted as we edged closer to one another. Howie raised his hand and warned us to stay close because goblins always grab stragglers. I squeezed Indian maiden Barbara Green's hand, glad to know she was 2 years older and packing a real tomahawk. Just then, dry leaves crackled in the underbrush, and out came a black cloaked devil, pitchfork, tail, red horns and all, a specter that did more to make us good Christians than all the church sermons of our young lives. We grabbed one another in terror, screaming no, as Doug Sadowski, a man who mother said was already showing signs of madness, removed his satanic mask and laughed hysterically to the delight of 20 back-slapping, hooting parents. Howie the ghost took one last drag, switched his ciggy into the grass, and marched us down the street to get the candy. One person not happy was Mother, who later spoke low to Daddy, saying, "It was no wonder Jackie was afraid of the dark."
Wow. That is a fabulous memory of a Halloween past. You mentioned there's 40 homes there for the vets in Mianus Village. I mean, was that your world for a long time, that you kind of stayed within, kind of felt like it was a cocoon for you and the kids growing up there?
It was outside of that little village alongside the river. And by the way, on the other side of the street was a wooded hill. So it was our world. Everything outside of that was vague as fog, and visiting relatives and going to church and school, but that was the world.
Jack, I have so many I want to hear, but I'm going to pick Sister Annunciata for my next selection for you to read.
Sister Annunciata, sure. Rick, you go to Catholic grammar school by
Oh, yes, I did. And most were not like her. I did have one, Sister Agnes Bernard, who was kind of a throwback to the Sister Annunciata days. So,
I volunteer at a local nursing home where we have many Mercy nuns. And They are wonderful people who have dedicated their lives, you know, to helping people and educating. But, you know, every once in a while in any group, human group, you're going to get an outlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that Seattle was our outlier, but I'll read this one to you. Sister Annunciata never killed anyone, but I expected death that day when rosary beef rattling, she swooped down on me just as I let fly a spitball. Unlike most nuns who were meek and mild brides of Christ, this one was a reincarnated bride of Frankenstein who worked her ruler like a switchblade and cut my knuckles until they bled. Bobby Vincenzi, a born wise guy, got it bad one Wednesday morning during a catechism B. I said a prayer for him when he threw the question, what are the eight Beatitudes? He smiled at Sister and said, there's a new family that just moved into Riverside Lane. Well, she was on him like Jesus on the money changers, breaking her ruler on his raised arms, then hitting him with a haymaker that would have floored Floyd Patterson. It wasn't funny, of course, but Bobby started carrying home his Baltimore catechism after that.
Oh, yeah, that takes me right back to St. Simon and Jude School in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I love that a lot. Hey, why don't you pick one? I always love when you get to choose, so it's your turn.
This is another of the three in the original collection that was sent to Antrim House Books. And Randy McQuilkin, of course, loved this one. And it's also emblematic of the colorful and eccentric characters that, were among these greatest generation soldiers who were living all over the country. Tires. The butler house at the end of the street reeked of gasoline fumes, which I loved to inhale. Whenever their boy Buddy and I went inside for Kool-Aid and slices of Wonder Bread, you know the kind guaranteed to build strong bodies 12 ways, especially when splattered with butter and sugar. Buddy's father was a truck driver with an Elvis pompadour who always wore a turquoise work shirt with Floyd stenciled across his breast pocket. His wife, Betty Lou, was a big-breasted woman with a green and a blue eye who held Floyd's hand in public and wasn't shy about French kissing him when he came off the road. I love the way the butlers turned a wrecked 53 Chevy into a playhouse, lined their driveway with white wall retreads, made wind chimes out of hubcaps, and filled the backhoe tire with sugary sand direct from Daytona Beach. Best of all was the tire swing dangling from a long rope on a knotty oak limb. I still can feel the queasy rush as the tire soared like a black vulture over the shimmering river. Betty Lou liked me a lot and always asked me when Jackie was going to get a girlfriend, which made me nervous because I never knew which eye to look at when talking to her.
What I love about these stories, Jack, is I had to keep checking. Now, Mianna's Village, it's in Greenwich. It's part of Greenwich, right? Because this is not the posh Greenwich that you write about.
No, absolutely. You know, my mother, we were working class. My father, after the war, took a job in the Electrolux vacuum cleaner factory. He was assembly line there for 30 years. My mom had gone to secretarial school after high school, but she was a secretary and personal assistant to a lot of these blue bloods in Greenwich. You know, Greenwich in those days was the fourth richest, town in the United States. It's still right up there. And unfortunately, it's become an enclave for the hedge fund refugees from New York City. So there's just an awful lot of development, and you'd hardly recognize the place from the 50s and 60s. But yeah, there were two sides of the track for sure in Greenwich. And we had the opportunity to, especially through my mom, to interact with both of them.
Mm. Now, another one that really resonated with me, and this is my favorite in the collection, page 61 is Paperboy. I hope you'll read it for us.
Okay, sure. Yeah, 60 Paperboy. Yeah. paperboy. Ricky Holmes sold me his Greenwich Time paper route for $10, a Mickey Mantle baseball card, and a promise to let him copy my algebra homework. On Friday afternoons, I'd knock on 50 doors, collect 75 cents each for the week's deliveries. Most people tipped a quarter or so, but not Mr. Hines, the retired English teacher, who made my week one October day by inviting me into a book-bound living room and slipping me a $5 tip. His latest poem had just been published in the Fordham Review. He called it The Subjunctive Mood and asked his wife to read it aloud. If only Adam disliked apples, Pilate freed Jesus, Mozart lived to 80, Lincoln hated plays, the Archduke survived Sarajevo, Hitler been a pacifist, Arabs loved Jews, the atom bomb fizzled, communists admired capitalists, Oswald missed, and for you and me, dear, Ponce de Leon found the fountain of youth. That Christmas, Mr. Hines gave me a copy of Robert Frost's collected poems, which have been whispering in my ears ever since.
Wow. I love that. I love the poem and the poem within the poem. And I'm still wondering if you rued the deal by throwing in the Mickey Mantle card for the paper route.
One of the worst mistakes of my life. That card. 100,000 now, right?
Exactly. Oh, man. I was a paper boy. There were three boys, and I delivered one-third and then one-half of the route. I never got paid. It was like the family thing to do. It's the family's paper route, and I just delivered papers. I did not understand the free enterprise system at that point in my life. So when I love that you got the big $5 tip. What was it like, Jack, going back to Mayanus Village 50 years after leaving there?
Well, you know, to me, the forward march of time is forever frozen in about 1960. You know, we're talking a time of optimism. Sure, there was the Cold War, but there was a time of safety and optimism. Kennedy had just been elected. We were going forward and, you know, promising to go to the moon. So many things were possible back then before the assassination and, of course, Vietnam and all of the turmoil that came after it. So it was a very, very simple, safe time. Kids went out to play, and I remember my mom would always just say, come back by dark.
Mm-hmm.
And we hitchhiked, and even girls hitchhiked all over town. And none of us ever ended up with our picture in the post office, you know, a missing child. The gun violence, unheard of. Although I'll tell you, those Greatest Generation guys were well armed. A lot of them had brought souvenirs home from the war. And I remember asking my father, you know, how we managed to get this German Luger, into the house. How we got it. He said, I just put it in my duffel bag, you know, and brought it home. Mm-hmm. So there were all kinds of souvenirs, but it was a safe and safe time.
Yeah. And we've got about a minute left, Jack, but what imprints did that village leave on you?
Well, in a minute. The moral compass wasn't intact in those days. And sadly, I think, for, you know, a lot of America, the moral compass has just fallen apart in this turbocharged, society in which we live. So, but people were honest. And also one thing, if I can finish this real quick, if you broke the law, you were in more trouble with your parents than you were with the cops. And I do remember my brother, you know, snitching some magic markers from a local store, brought him home, and my mother caught him. She marched him back to the store, mm-hmm. brought him right up to the manager, made him return them, promised never to steal again. And, 50 years hence, that guy has never stolen anything.
Right.
So, yeah.
And there's a great poem about honesty. We don't have time for, but please pick up the collection. It's called Coach Garofalo, Me and the Truth, and it is a beauty. Jack T. Scully's new book of poetry is called Miami's Village. It's available at AntrimHouseBooks.com. Anywhere else people can pick it up, Jack?
Yeah, you know, thanks to print on demand, they can get the book directly from me now by just going to the website authorjacktscully.com. These are autographed copies at about 25% less than Amazon. So, yeah, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and my website.
Okay. Authorjacktscully.com. Jack, thanks so much for sharing your poetry with us this morning.
All right. Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Take care. News is next. Then we'll be back for a half hour of open phones. Coming up at noon today, we do have the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All right, the phones are open again until 11 o'clock this morning, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. Now, earlier we talked about the splendid Splinter Vacation Rental, a place where Ted Williams and his wife lived down in Westminster West, and got this wonderful email just as we finished that segment from Pam. And she says, Ted would come to our house in Holton, Maine, and go fishing on the Canes River with my dad. They met through the owner of my dad's company, who had a fishing camp in New Brunswick. He always loved kids, always was good to me, but my mom couldn't stand him, as he was, in her determination, arrogant, and took my dad off for a week or two of whiskey, cards, and fishing. It sounds like Ted Williams. Dad and mom went on his second honeymoon to New Brunswick with his wife, Lee, as Ted looked for property up there. We saw him at Logan in 1968 when he was with the Senators. Dad yelled across to him, "Hey, Bush," as in Bush League, and he came over, picked me up at 13, called me Pammy. I had seen their first baseman, Frank Howard, who was a big guy, then Ted, and then later the Red Sox as they were boarding a flight. I was over the moon. I sent him a note to congratulate him on his 406 season 50th anniversary and didn't expect to hear back. I did, and knew it was authentic, as he commented on what an authentic, honest, and strong woman was my mother. She would have been shocked. And he invited me to contact Claudia when she was a student at Middlebury College. Followed his story closely, but will remember his kindness to this kid. And she says she'll check out the B&B when she wins the lottery. Good luck, Pam. I hope you do. And I hope you invite me. I'll stay right next door in the Sweet House Barn, if you don't mind. All right, we're opening the phones. We're going to hear about wonderful places to eat in Quebec. We'll hear about whatever you want to talk about. The numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And we go, oh, yes, to the Duke of Newbury. Fred joins us. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Hey, there's a couple of things I have a comment on. And one is, you know, I listen to the news. I'm like a news freak. Mm-hmm. And I listen to Fox. I listen to MSR and CNN. And I'm trying to get an idea of what's going on down at the border. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a big deal going on down there, according to Fox. And I'm wondering if that's, you know, fake news. They say the border is out of control. They say the border is going to be a big super spreader because they're shipping people all over the United States now that come in here. They don't test them. They don't do that sort of thing. And you know, I'm really nervous about that. I think that possibility could be true. And then one final observation is I think the governors and the state legislatures should pass a law saying that if you don't have a COVID-19 vaccination card, you can't vote.
Interesting. Wow, Fred. First of all, interesting observation about what's happening at the border. I think it's probably, you know, somewhere. Yeah. First of all, any news today, Fred, it's almost like take Fox and take MSNBC and then find somewhere in the middle. And that's probably closest to the truth. But I'm sure, you know, it seems highly unlikely that they wouldn't be doing testing. That seems only, you know, like the basic thing, you know, they should and would be doing. But, you know, what the government should do or would do, we don't always know if that happens. And so if it's not happening, it's wrong. And then to move people who haven't been tested elsewhere in the United States seems so counterintuitive to everything we're being told about the efforts to stop this COVID-19, especially with the Delta variant. So I don't know the answer, Fred. I don't know if we ever will, but I sure hope that is not what is going on. Now, a very interesting proposition about having people have to be vaccinated to vote. You know, I want everybody to be vaccinated. That is a top priority, and I make no bones about that. I'm vaccinated, double vaxxed, and, you know, it's been a number of months, and I'm very happy about that. Do we put a barrier between people in voting? You know, maybe it's voting in person, Fred, and if you, you know, can't vote in person. You're not vaxxed. You can't vote in person and have to do it by absentee. But very interesting theory, and that's why you are the Duke of Newbury. And I love those thoughts today. Thanks so much for sharing those, Fred. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. If you've got thoughts about what Fred has proposed, we'd love to hear that too. You know, I know it's difficult for companies, for anyone who owns a company to demand vaccination, you know, but the military's doing it. There's been hospitals down in the Houston area where things have gotten out of control who have done it and given, you know, a certain amount of time for people to get vaccinated and have had, you know, to lose people. You know, who refuse to get vaccinated, even with the threat of losing their jobs. Do we tie voting to it? Wow, Fred, that is one of your best questions ever. Let me think. I'm going to roll that around a bit. All right, so I'm going to move to a lighter topic and one that I love, and you know it's eating. We have talked about, you know, the border reopening as of yesterday, and where we'd like to go once we get back up into Quebec. And I have mentioned Dunn's for the smoked meat sandwiches, Basha, or any place that I am close to that has Lebanese food. Now, there's a wonderful fine contemporary French cuisine restaurant called La Lou, and that is phenomenal. This is a place that was recommended to me by a coworker years ago. I went and enjoyed a fabulous meal, and then I have recommended it to several people, and they continue to go back. I think it was closed for a while, but La Lou. I mentioned earlier Luf in Mystic, which is just outside of Bedford. It's French country cuisine, and it is phenomenal. Now, we had several people say they love getting up to the botanical gardens. Oh, oui. It's out at Pinneuf on the metro line. You hop off the Pinneuf stop, and you're right there at the botanical gardens. And, you know, you're right across the street from the Big O, Olympic Stadium, which looks kind of like, when you see it from the outside, a spaceship that has crashed landed, stuck into the ground sideways. But you can check it out, and sometimes it's being repaired, but you can take the elevator up that tower. It does take a ticket But it's great fun. Gives you a great view of Montreal, and it is really a wonderful time. You're right there at the Botanical Gardens. I think the Insectarium is nearby. So when you're out there off the Pinneuf metro stop, there's a lot of fun stuff to do. All right. Now, Craig Durham and I both highly recommend that you beat it up Saint Laurent to Fairmont Avenue. And I've only done three of these, but I remembered something last night. It's really a quadruple header that you want to do. This is in the Mile End area of Montreal. And on Fairmont Avenue, first of all, there's something called the Drogheria Fine. And it is this little counter. I mean, you can almost walk by, except you smell this wonderful Italian sauce being cooked there. And if you're there during the week at lunchtime, you'll notice a long line. It is a little counter where they sell a $5 container of amazing gnocchi with the sauce that they make there. And you're going to be hard-pressed to finish the $5 Canadian worth of gnocchi. It's that much. And then they have their sauce. It's called La Salsa della Nonna. And as much as you can possibly carry at $10 Canadian a jar, bring it home. You will absolutely love it. You might just drink it from the jar. It's that delicious. All right, that's the first stop. Back across the street, there's a little place. This is the one I haven't tried, but I've seen people coming over with these sandwiches. It's Walensky's Light Lunch, and you get the special. And if anyone's had it, please call in and let us know. But here's what it is. It's fried salami and fried bologna, a little bit of mustard on a roll, and they make no exceptions. That's the special. That's how they serve it. They won't cut it in half. They won't add this. They won't take that off. And that's what you get at Walensky's Light Lunch. This is all, honestly, you could stumble from place to place right here on Fairmont and enjoy this. Next is Kemkoba, the ice cream. The line moves fast. There's always a line down to the corner, but don't worry. It moves fast. So many great flavors, but if they have the sweet butter ice cream, oh my. Please, as a Vermonter, you owe it to yourself to try that. And then a couple doors down, you go back past the little Italian place and get in line at Fairmont Bagel and buy some the all-dressed Montreal-style bagels there or whatever kind you like, but the all-dressed are best, and bring them back home. And right there in that one little section, you have the best of the MTL. I am telling you, it is worth the trip up and back. Park the car for about 20 minutes, fill your belly, drive home. Say, didn't you just come through? Yeah, yeah. What do you got? I got sauce and I got bagels. You go right through. Also, Fred, the Duke of Newbury's proposal of voters be vaxxed. Should you need to have a vaccination, the COVID-19 vaccination, to be able to vote? Interesting proposal by the Duke of Newbury this morning. Does it block people from voting? You know, I do love the voter turnouts that we have had, especially here in Vermont, even for primaries in the last few cycles. It's exciting news. You know, we hate to see when there's 40% turnout or 50% turnout, because come on, you're letting half of your state or your country decide for you. So voting is really key. I can't stress that enough. And I do, you know, the League of Women Voters probably will love me, you know, because I want people to vote. I want everyone to vote. But I also want everybody to be vaxxed. We need to be safe here. This is a worldwide pandemic, and the longer it goes on, the more variants develop. You get that? We've got the Delta. Lambda's next. When we start hearing about the Lambda variant, it means another variant is spreading somewhere in the world, and it will be here. I had started wearing a mask again, and boy, it was really difficult to throw on a mask in the first place, right? But you figure it out, right? You get in the habit. I have masks everywhere. Got one right here. I got them, you know, in my briefcase. I got them in the car. I got them at home. So even if I walk out the door without a mask, I still got them somewhere, right? And today I had to relearn how to wear the mask again, when to put it on. You know, every little time I'm away from my desk, I walk from my car to the house or to the office. It has begun again. So Fred's idea of people being vaxxed to be able to vote is interesting, but will it motivate people to roll up the sleeve? I mentioned this time and time again about Vermont hitting, what are we at, 84%, Danny? We somewhere around there. And you can roll into any of our little town centers right now, and we're getting a lot of action, a lot of tourists, and we thank them for coming here. But why they come into Vermont? Well, they feel pretty darn safe in a place where people behaved, where people are getting vaccinated at that high rate. But the Delta variant, is here. We're seeing numbers climb again of people being infected. Numbers in the hospitals climbing again. We don't want that. So all I can ask is think about again and again, you know, why you're not getting vaccinated, really look at what's happened. So many people have been vaccinated. The FDA approval, got to be on the way. I think we've proved that the vaccination really is the safe route to beat COVID, not just doing it unmasked and unvaxxed. All right, your thoughts, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You have the opportunity to jump in. We got a few more minutes, a sneaker in or here or there. We'll try to get to you. If not, you got to listen to me talk about eating in Quebec. Oh, my God, do I love it there. I'll talk about Loof again. I mentioned it in the 9 o'clock hour. It's up in Mystic. So if you go into Bedford and then just head north a little bit, there's a little village called Mystic, and it's really lovely. There's a round barn. It's like a 16-sided round barn. There's this little shop that has chocolates up front, and then the restaurant Loof in the back. And I think there are some like B&B units, apartments upstairs that you can stay in. And the food is French country. It is unbelievable cuisine, lovely people. And I'd highly recommend making sure they're open and always get a reservation. But I can remember coming out of there one night, and the little church steeple was lit up, and the hall down the street was lit, and it felt like you had just walked out into a small French village. And I called it Le Oeuf when I was looking for it the first time, and learned it is l'œuf, which means the egg. And I will highly recommend it. Okay, looks like we're at, Danny's telling me, 84.6% now. Wow, we're getting on to 85%. People are still getting vaccinated here in Vermont. And as a matter of fact, the antique and custom car meet that's going on this Friday through Sunday, I think they're going to have the opportunity for you to get vaccinated there, which is outstanding. The excuse that it's inconvenient or that you can't find a place is probably not one that will wash at this point. All right. What do we got? I guess we're going to have to wrap things up without a final call. Anybody want to sneak in? No. All right, that'll do it. All right, so what do we got? Danny, you know what to do. You got to shut it down. That'll be it for the calls this morning. Tomorrow we got a full show, so we won't be opening the phones. Maybe Thursday. We'll see what happens. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is so adeptly and adroitly directed by Mr. Danny McGivergan, produced by Rachel Connor and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Love hearing your suggestions for topics or guests or your feedback of what we've done. Always please send it our way. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Yeah, subscribe, and then you get them delivered to your inbox every day. You won't miss one. Common Sense Radio, Bill Sayre is up next, and he's opened it up for the governor today. The governor's COVID-19 response news conference will follow CBS News at noon. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.